From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush said unequivocally in his State of the Union address on Tuesday that the United States is winning the war on terror. And he said leading a coalition to disarm Iraq is part and parcel of the effort to destroy the global terror web. Maybe so. But not all Americans have been convinced on either count. Tonight on Point, how the U.S. is really faring in the war on terror. First, new developments today in the effort to push Saddam Hussein into exile instead of war. President Bush said today that he would welcome exile for Saddam and his top henchmen. In Washington, the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud Al-Faisal, met today with the president, with exile reportedly on the agenda. Christopher Marquez is a reporter with the New York Times. I asked how the meeting came about and what we know about its outcome.
We don't know a lot of details yet about the meeting at the White House this afternoon, but what we do know is that the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud, watched President Bush's State of the Union address on Tuesday and responded very quickly with the determination to meet with President Bush and discuss, among other things, the possibility of finding a way to persuade Saddam Hussein to go into exile.
The Saudis have reportedly been hot on this for a while. Why is Prince Saud suddenly pushing hard, not just in the U.S., but in Europe as well?
The Saudi sense is they want to give the impression that they have tried every possible option, exhausted all the possibilities before they and the international community can sign off on a war against Saddam Hussein.
So how would exile for Saddam Hussein work? Have any details come out about how it might be offered to him, whether it's been offered to him already, and how it might unfold?
The first thing to know is that virtually all the players involved think it's a long shot. They think it's highly unlikely that Saddam Hussein will pack up and relocate, accept an amnesty for himself and his officers and family and the like. But they think it's worth making the offer. Even President Bush today was quoted as saying that he thought it would be worth a try to avoid a war. Secretaries Rumsfeld and Powell have both weighed in, signaling that too. So it seems there's a consensus that the United States and the international community should at least go through the motions of offering some kind of exile, complete with amnesty, to Saddam Hussein and his senior people.
Are we talking then about a formal public offer of amnesty and exile? And if so, where might that originate and how?
Yeah, the Arab proponents say that it would have to be a publicly endorsed offer because otherwise Saddam Hussein would not lend it any credibility.
In other words, he couldn't or wouldn't trust it if
exactly.
It were private.
Mm-hmm. So the notion would be perhaps to introduce a resolution at the United Nations in the Security Council that would lay out the terms of exile.
Is Saudi Arabia offering a palace somewhere in its desert sands, Christopher Marquez?
The Saudis are being very coy about their entire role in this process. In fact, Prince Saud today emerged from the White House and said that the issue had not even been broached with President Bush, although the indications that I'm hearing are other than that. They do not want their fingerprints on this. They want this to be perceived as a broader effort involving the international community. But it's anyone's guess as to what kinds of inducements they're considering. From what I've heard, Saudi Arabia would not be Saddam Hussein's primary choice of a place to relocate. Mm. Most people think that he would be looking more toward a state in the former Soviet Union.
Again, a long shot. Christopher Marquez, how do you read the bottom line of Saudi interest here? In Paris, the foreign minister said after a meeting with French President Jacques Chirac that what Saudi Arabia is hoping for is to avoid the dismemberment of Iraq, maintaining its territorial integrity. Is that the number one concern? Are they worried about the whole region and its boundaries coming apart? Do they really want to avoid war at all costs?
No, indeed, they are very concerned about maintaining stability in the region. And for the reasons most of us are familiar with, the idea that a nation on the Saudi border could disintegrate into the various factions that are effectively suppressed by the iron hand of Saddam Hussein is very troubling to the Saudis. And that's the primary goal is, from the Saudi standpoint, is a stabilizing, peaceful transition. And that's what they're eager to talk to the White House about.
Presumably, given the doubt that Saddam Hussein will actually accept such an offer, if indeed it's publicly, formally made, there were other agenda items as well. Are we imagining, or do we know if they're talking about U.S. forces on Saudi soil, what bases will be used, the practical aspects of going to war?
All of that is indeed under discussion. The Bush administration is being careful not to put the cart before the horse and perhaps give the impression that war is imminent, but the Saudis were mobilized by the State of the Union address in a way that showed that they believe war is imminent, and they are doing whatever they can to exhaust the diplomatic options.
So they feel the war heating up now. It feels very real to them. What's the thinking? What are the odds? Is it a minute possibility that Saddam Hussein would actually take this offer, or are people still wishing, hoping, as you say, they're certainly publicly commenting now, that he will and might simply walk?
It's highly unlikely that Saddam Hussein will accept an offer into exile based on what everyone knows about him. The thinking is that offering exile is checking off one more box that needs to be checked before actual war can begin.
Well, we'll wait and see if the offer actually comes. Hard to imagine him taking it, but what a story. Christopher Marquis, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Christopher Marquis is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. One by one, that's how terrorists worldwide are learning the meaning of American justice. President Bush said in his State of the Union address, Saddam Hussein, he suggested, is likely only weeks away from learning that meaning of American justice. But are we, in fact, winning the war on terror? And does invading Iraq help or hinder the cause? Serious observers come down on both sides of both questions. Tonight, we sort through the evidence and the arguments, the claims and the counterclaims, and the truth really matters here. As America sets its sights on Iraq, we gauge our success in the bigger battle, the global war on terror. Do you share the president's confidence that we are winning that war, the war on terror? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the member of MIT's Security Studies Program. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Van Evra.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Steve.
Hi, Jack.
Stephen Evra, we know you've been watching and watching closely from the very beginning of this whole great saga. You watched, I'm sure, along with everyone else on Tuesday night, the president say, we are winning this war. One by one, we're taking the terrorists down. Do you agree? Are we winning?
He's wrong. We're not winning. The war on terror is not going well. If you use objective metrics of success, we've now killed or captured only 40% of al-Qaeda's pre-9/11 elite and dealing with their top elite is essential to winning the war. German intelligence just reported a couple of days ago that in their estimation, al-Qaeda is as strong today as they were before 9/11. Our own intelligence has been warning that al-Qaeda can still pack a punch. We've got them on the run. They no longer have a secure haven, and the haven they had in Afghanistan was very useful. But they've escaped, and they're much harder to find now because they've dispersed. And I think they learned a lot about our vulnerabilities from the whole discussion we've had since 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I think we should draw no comfort from the fact that we've not had a major attack since 9/11 because the usual rhythm of their attack pattern is to take, you know, a couple of years between big ones.
But the impression we get from the president is they are on the run. They don't have the leisure of planning attacks. They don't have the means necessarily. The sense is, by golly, one by one, we're tracking them down. They're living in fear. And the suggestion, I guess, from that we are not as vulnerable as we were.
I don't think we're making progress as fast as we're losing ground. 6 months ago, if you did a head count of how many of the top 30 we had caught, it was about a third. Mm-hmm. We moved that up, 10%. Meanwhile, they're recruiting new leaders, they're training them, they're reconstituting the organization. So I think we're treading water here. I don't see progress.
We'll look at the details of that, but I want to make the link right away to the war in Iraq, or at least President Bush has made the link. And the notion there is, if we flatten Saddam, we take out a potential ally to al-Qaeda and global terrorism, and thereby significantly advance our cause in the war on terror.
I think that the war in Iraq is a distraction from the war on terror. It's a mental distraction. It takes our foreign policy folk off the subject. They have to use their policy thinking time on something else. It distracts our military, and perhaps most important, it distracts our intelligence agencies. The war on terror will be won, if it is won, by our intelligence folk. Dealing with al-Qaeda is easy if you know where they are. The problem is finding them. That's up to the intelligence people. And our Mideast intelligence capabilities were left in ruins at the end of the Cold War. We didn't have, hardly any human. We moved heavily into high-tech gizmos.
Humans on the ground, in the language, in the culture.
Correct. Two big mistakes. One is we went into gizmos, not people. And the second is we ignored the Mideast in general. So we had very little intelligence capacity in the Mideast. We're now going to stretch that even thinner by putting a good chunk of our intelligence people on the Iraq case when we need them on the al-Qaeda case. Second thing is in our military, we only have a finite number of Arab speakers. And they're going to be tied up administering Iraq now for years to come. So we need them out there looking for al-Qaeda.
So draw the diagram for us. In your mind, the two circles, war on Iraq, war on terror, how much do they intersect?
I don't think they intersect at all. In fact, I think there's, danger that one will disrupt the other. If we bungle the war in Iraq, we can create more recruits for al-Qaeda. Unless this war smells really nice in the Arab world, mm-hmm. looks good, looks like a just and decent thing to do.
The right thing, done for the right reasons, done the right way.
Correct. Unless we come off smelling like roses here, we're going to create recruits for al-Qaeda. Bin Laden's whole litany is that we are the great imperialist invading the Muslim world. We're playing to type here. We're filling his script. His whole strategy has been to suck us into some kind of overstretch, some kind of imperial lunge in the Mideast, which he could then use to mobilize his followers.
Jack Beatty, we're going to push Steve Van Evere into the details, but there's the big picture. He says, A, we're not winning the war on terror, we're losing it, and B, war on Iraq will not advance the cause, it will set us back.
Well, the Bush people cite five undoubted successes, it seems to me. One, personnel. Steve mentioned some of this, but the president spoke to it. He mentioned that we had the chief of al-Qaeda operations in the Persian Gulf, the man who directed logistics and funding for September 11th. He went on and he said, all told, more than 3,000 suspects have been arrested in many countries. Two, the administration has reoriented the FBI away from crime investigation to terrorism prevention, a very significant step. Three, the passage in the Patriot Act of tough anti-terror measures, many of which are pinching, to judge by the wrath they've drawn from the ACLU. Fourth, and above all, I think, the ending, and Steve mentioned this, of the Afghanistan safe haven for al-Qaeda and the still problematic but encouraging effort to install a strong pro-Western government there. And fifth, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which, at least on paper, looks to be better aligned, to better align our homeland defenses than they were before 9/11. And sixth, I suppose, the administration says, wait a minute, the roots of al-Qaeda lie in the authoritarian practices of the regimes in the Middle East. The way to affect those regimes, to change them, is by creating democracy in Iraq.
Stephen Everett, there's a big buffet, more than we can get to before the break, but take it on its face. That looks like quite a litany.
Well, the personnel front, as I said, if you've only got 40% of the elite and you've given them a year and a half to rebuild, that's way too slow. The president was giving examples of people we've gotten.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, well, he should give examples of the ones we haven't, like Osama bin Laden.
Yes, for one.
Yes, and Haiman al-Zawahiri, who's the head of their operations. He's the real genius behind their whole operational
system. Still at large.
Yes, and then the president should give examples of all the new leaders that have been recruited and trained since then, because the word is that they've replaced a number of their losses.
But we've redirected the FBI.
Have we really? Where's the proof of that? I don't believe we have. I think the FBI really can't be redirected. The whole culture of that organization is crime fighting and crime stopping. It's not terror stopping. And I think that we have to create a special dedicated counterterror police force for the U.S.
We've got a lot to talk about tonight. Stephen Everett, please stand by. Jack Beatty, we're looking at the other war, the war on terror, and asking, are we winning? President Bush says yes. Others, not so sure. We'll hear both those voices tonight. Are we winning, in your mind, that war on terror? Does war on Iraq help or hurt the cause? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're grading the war on terror tonight. On Tuesday night, President Bush took up the theme. He said, we're winning. Let's listen to just a little bit of the president's message.
There are days when our fellow citizens do not hear news about the war on terror. There's never a day when I do not learn of another threat or receive reports of operations in progress or give an order in this global war against a scattered network of killers. The war goes on, and we are winning.
And we are winning. Do you share the president's confidence that terrorists will, one by one, learn the meaning of American justice? Is one by one enough? How do we dissuade a generation of potential terrorists? And is war on Iraq key, or is it a diversion? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest in the studio tonight is Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a member of MIT's Security Studies Program. There it is again, Stephen Van Evra. Every day, I, the president, get reports of advances that we're making.
Well, I think he's trying to claim he's done a good job here. He's making the best of a bad case. I think if you look at the rest of Jack Beatty's points, the situation looks bad on the rest of the points.
The Patriot Act was there. The tightening that's gone on across the country on civil liberties and attendant to that, we would hope some tightening of the security network.
Well, I agree, and I do think that they made some changes in the regulations regarding wiretaps, which were appropriate and have helped. It used to be the case that if you were chasing terrorists, you had to get a new warrant for every single cell phone. Mm-hmm. And, of course, your average terrorist.
To do. Yeah, your average five or six.
Right. He'd throw one away after each phone call, and then you're back to talk to the judge again. And those changes have been made. But if you look at the overall picture on Homeland Security, there's a great deal that hasn't been done. And I don't think the administration has a serious Homeland Security program.
What are the undone elements in your mind?
Engaging local law enforcement seriously with this war. Local law enforcement is the cutting edge of catching terrorists in this country. And today, a police officer in the U.S. who stops somebody can't even have access to a terror list to see if the person he stopped is wanted. Okay.
That's impressive, unimpressive.
Yeah, extremely unimpressive. And the FBI has all their reasons why this is impossible. But, come on, get mm-hmm, real here. Mm-hmm. They aren't being trained in dealing with the real terror threats we face, including chem and bio attack. We have no program to thicken up our national public health structure. We have to realize that the danger of a bio attack is quite real and serious, and we have to make major investment in public health to cope with that. The administration is investing some money in research on vaccines and treatments, but they got to go much further. Nuclear plants, chemical plants, and our ports are still very vulnerable to attack, and we have not moved to upgrade them. If you look at control of our borders is still terrible. And the idea of having one face at the border instead of four, which is a premise of the Homeland Security program, is a good idea.
One face at the border instead of four?
Right now we have
different agencies.
Four agencies meet you at the border when you mm-hmm. come to the U.S., which just creates complete chaos. And the Homeland Security program is to create one face. That's a good idea.
But what about the Office of Homeland Security? And how can it be that we're failing on all these points, these check boxes that you leave here without a check in the box? What's the fundamental lack of motivation, lack of organization? What does this boil down to?
I think it's that the president thinks you can win this war by offense alone. He thinks that going abroad and smacking al-Qaeda is enough, that if we unleash the military and send them to the places where the terrorists are found, we can win the war that way. I think this war is much tougher to win, and the way I think of it is there's four fronts you got to fight on. You got to fight all out on all four of them. One is the offense, rolling up al-Qaeda mm-hmm. and denying it sanctuaries. But the second is buttoning down America. The third is a war of ideas. We need to change the terms of debate in the Islamic world. If we don't, we'll never come to a modus vivendi with mm-hmm. the Islamist world, which is a big world. Mm-hmm. And fourth is, I call it special teams, but I mean locking down weapons of mass destruction around the world that terrorists might get hold of and bring here, either by stealing them or buying them. And the big problem there is Russia, but Russia is not the only place where these things are loose. And we're doing way too little on those other three elements: homeland security, war of ideas, and locking down loose nukes. The last story is the worst, which is the loose nukes issue, where we're doing just way too little.
But nowhere on this list do I really hear Iraq.
Yeah, Iraq's not on that list.
There's a picture. Jack Beatty, Stephen Evers come back at most of the list that you laid out there. This is a president who, as we said on Tuesday night, likes to swing for the fences. Steve paints a picture of him swinging for the fences in war with Iraq, but it's not necessarily a ball game that will win the terror struggle.
No, I share that apprehension fully. When you think about the war on terror, right after September 11th, a national conversation began. And if carried through, I think it might have led to a different strategy in the war on terror. I mean, the conversation was really about why. Why did they do this? What was the reason? And we really know. I mean, I talked to Peter Bergen, one of two Western journalists who's actually interviewed Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. And he spoke to him in 1998, I think just after or around the time he declared a jihad against the United States. And he said, why? Why are you doing this? And he gave him pretty much three reasons. The first was our bases in Saudi Arabia, the footprint of the infidel on the Holy Land. The second was the U.S. sanctions against Iraq and their cruel effect, catastrophic effect, some people think, on child mortality and health generally. And, of course, there are other reasons for that. And, of course, third was the continued U.S. and not just tilt, but alliance with Israel to the exclusion of a just settlement with the Palestinians. Well, all right, those were the reasons for the attack. Now, to talk about them isn't to justify the attack. But what happened? Suddenly, the political motives for these terrorist acts were sort of wafted away, and what we got were metaphysical motives, evil. They hate our freedom. And the notion that our policy, not by being cruel, but just by its unintended consequences, could have helped to bring this about, and that these complaints weren't just unique to bin Laden, that got brushed away in this talk about evil. And we haven't begun even to take the steps that those particular complaints would oblige us to take long term to end the terrorist threat.
And yet we know there's another huge perspective on this, that going into Iraq, getting Saddam out, planting democracy there, and beginning a kind of revolution in the Middle East may, in fact, be the strong offense taking it to the enemy way to win in this war. I want to welcome into our conversation Victor Davis Hanson. He's a professor of classics at California State University at Fresno and visiting professor of military history at the Naval Academy. Good evening and welcome, Victor Davis Hanson.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Victor Davis Hanson, we're looking at the war on terror, the war on Iraq tonight, but most of all the war on terror. Are we, as the president said on Tuesday night, are we winning that war?
Well, I think on a historical perspective, you should ask yourself, since the war broke out on September 11th, are we more afraid and are we more, have we experienced more attacks, or have the people who've done it, are they in hiding and are they on a run? And I think the momentum has shifted radically. And I think they're in much worse shape than we are. We haven't done everything right, but we're making a lot of progress. I'd like to just address something that was said about the motives. Historically, it doesn't make much sense necessarily to worry what bin Laden or said the motives were of the terrorists. Hitler and the Japanese militarists, they had all sorts of reasons why they went to war. Everything from blockades to the Versailles Treaty to the Jews, and a lot of them were, in fact, the same fascistic dribble that Osama bin Laden said. He also said, remember, that Jewish women were walking with bare arms in Mecca. So I don't think it's going to do us much good to worry whether some fanatic who's a mass murderer has points that he can make in the same manner that Hitler and Tojo did.
But Victor Davis Hanson, what about this big question of the right dynamic for going after terrorists, terrorism? Our guest Stephen Van Evere here in the studio says President Bush is too focused on offense. He's not focused enough on defense, and that you can't win this by going out and whacking around Iraq.
I'd say two things. I share his concerns. I think he made some very good points, but remember that in each of his worries, that was almost as if Bush had not done enough. That is, he hadn't closed the borders enough. He hadn't shaped up the FBI enough. He hadn't had more integration with local law enforcement enough. But what he has done has been furiously opposed by all sorts of opponents, especially in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. So give him some credit that he's brought us away from what other people would not. The criticism of Bush by many people is he's gone too far, not that he's not gone far enough. As far as Iraq, for those who don't think that it's necessary, then we should ask ourselves, maybe we should just pull out altogether. We're already controlling two-thirds of Iraqi airspace. Do we want to cease doing that? We've trained a whole generation of American pilots who have risked their lives for 10 years, and the result of that is there's an independent federal republic state of Kurdistan, which is fighting for its life not only from Saddam Hussein, but also from al-Qaeda terrorists who operate with the sanction and encouragement of Saddam Hussein inside Kurdistan. And as far as the worry about commitment of troops in a postbellum operation, we've had 30,000 to 40,000 troops for over a decade in that region precisely to police Saddam Hussein. I think most Americans would rather have 30,000 or 40,000 troops protecting a democracy or helping the rebuilding of democracy than the last decade to protect feudalism from fascism.
Victor Davis Hanson, I hear in all that a defense of the war on Iraq. Does that extend, do you see it as an extension of the war on terror? If we have the kind of victory that's described there, does it actually help us with al-Qaeda? Does it lessen the terrorist threat in Manhattan, in San Francisco, you name it?
I think it does materially and psychologically. We should remember that we're told, even as we speak, that there's going to be information from the government that shows ties of al-Qaeda and Iraq. We know that people in al-Qaeda have had sanctuary in Iraq. We know that Iraq is a sponsor of international terrorism. There's no accident that people like Abu Abbas and Abu Nadal, the Osama bin Ladens of the 70s and 80s, had sanctuary in Iraq. We know the modus operandi is the same, just as we were attacked by suicide murderers on 9/11. So Saddam Hussein pays bounties to suicide murderers of $25,000 a head right now. So by going into Iraq and recreating the government and doing it in a way that's humane, we can stop not only oil revenues from subsidizing terror, but also we can stop a sanctuary, a large area that's right now being used by people in al-Qaeda in Kurdistan. In addition to that, it'll send a powerful message to al-Qaeda that there's not very many places in the world that we can't reach, and that the sanctuaries that they've used in the past, first Afghanistan and Iraq, are slowly drying up.
Victor Davis Hanson, I want to put all that to Stephen Van Evra, but a lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn first to the listeners. Alan's calling. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Hello. Actually, it's Owen. Owen Sherman calling from Boston, and I'd love to come across the river and talk to your guest. The last speaker, I think, hit some very important points. I think the problem isn't in the policy, but the polemics. If you have a fire in the living room and a fire in the bedroom, and you put just one of them out, you're really you're only partway there. I'd like your guest to address Kenneth Pollack's book, The Threatening Storm, which paraphrases Churchill's The Gathering Storm. Mm. Also to point out to your guest that he made some reference to our reliance on the CIA, and Mr. Pollack says he was a CIA analyst in Iraq before the attack occurred in Kuwait, and he couldn't get the information upstream through the agents.
But Owen, let me get to the heart of it with you. Are we winning the war on terror? What's your view?
We will win the war on terror if we address our domestic problem. And here's the way I see it. We will go to a war with Iraq. And once we go to a war with Iraq, al-Qaeda will attack. And they will try to create psychological linkage, because this is a problem of psychological warfare. And I would add to your guest that the homeland defense that we need to build is we need to build on the domestic front resolve and reserve and resilience against psychological warfare.
Owen, thanks for your call.
Come across and talk.
We've got it loud and clear. Let me put it to my guest, Stephen Van Evra. How about it? Vulnerability during war to an al-Qaeda attack. That's not a pretty picture.
I'm more worried about an Iraqi attack during the war. I think people should take a look at a terrific article in Foreign Affairs in January, February by Dick Betts, warning that Saddam has the capacity to hit us here in this country with weapons of mass destruction, and we're woefully unprepared. We haven't taken seriously this danger. Our borders are wide open. He can get anthrax in here if he wants. He can get smallpox in here if he's got it. He can get his agents in and out, no problem.
But Victor Davis Hanson says we're already hearing the cries from people saying civil liberties are being trampled on. Can we defend against those kind of attacks within a framework that Americans will accept?
Well, the question is, are we imprudent to go to war before we've dealt with the threat? That's Betz's argument. And I think we're taking a roll of the dice here. I think the roll will probably work out because I think Saddam probably won't attack us in this way. The reason why is because he is a magical thinker who will not believe he's going down until he's halfway down the tubes, and he won't have any time.
Too late to pull the trigger on an attack.
Correct. He won't pre-deploy an attack like this because if we caught him at it, that would give us casus belli, and he will go down quickly. This war, I think we will win quickly.
I think we should also keep in mind in history, madmen who threaten certain things, as I agree with the guest, don't quite pull it off. They always have a sense that they're going to survive in the 11th hour. Hitler promised to use poison gas. Milosevic promised to send suicide bombers into nuclear power plants in Europe. Saddam Hussein threatened chemical weapons the first time. So I don't think that it's necessarily true that just because he's trapped, he's going to have either the access or the ability or even the will to do it.
And what's your sense, Victor Davis Hanson, on the home front? Our caller Owen says, we have not built up the resolve, the resources. Civil liberties are one piece of this, but not the only piece. Is enough being done? Are Americans being given a realistic view of what the threat is and what's required to meet it?
Well, in some ways, the proof is in the pudding, and we've gone now over a year and a half, and we should remember that during that whole period, we've been threatened almost each month by various alerts, by various communiques from Osama bin Laden, even the other day, Saddam Hussein's son. Mm-hmm. So, and yet in that period, other than some al-Qaedistic activities, that is, local nuts like the shoe bomber or the sniper or whatever the anthrax was, we haven't had the same type of attack we saw in 9/11. I think that would have happened had we not been suddenly very vigilant. So we've changed for this country with its laxity and its tradition to open freedom to suddenly revolutionize the way that it conducts air travel in a mere year and a half has been quite extraordinary. I never thought in my lifetime I would be seeing people getting smallpox vaccinations again.
I guess none of us did, and yet there we are. So some steps are being taken. Victor Davis Hanson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Victor Davis Hanson is professor of classics at California State University, Fresno, and visiting professor of military history at the Naval Academy. Gosh, Jack Beatty, it's a huge mural, and there's so many points of vulnerability. Tough to ask anyone to cover all of them, and yet without that, the door's open.
Yes, it is. I just wanted to get back to a point that the Victor made, which is, he said that we shouldn't necessarily attend to the motives of this madman, bin Laden. Well, of course, the reason he picked those reasons and the reason those are his motives is because they're resonant. He's not the only one who has them. They are widely shared, especially the bases in Saudi Arabia and the implications that has for the sort of the clash of civilizations. So I don't say we have to truckle to them, but we certainly have to have a conversation about what are the causes of this terrorism.
Motivations fill the ranks of al-Qaeda, I guess. Listeners, are we winning the war on terror? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the other war, not on Iraq, but the war on terror. Are we winning that war? President Bush says yes, others are not so sure. How can we win the hearts and minds of would-be terrorists? Will war on Iraq win respect for America or more terror? And what's most important in this war on terror? Spies, soldiers, speechwriters, statesmen? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Stephen Van Evra, author of the book Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Stephen Van Evra, we heard Victor Davis Hanson saying there, Iraq is a sanctuary, get rid of the sanctuary, and you make progress in the war on terror.
Well, I don't think Iraq is a sanctuary for al-Qaeda. Victor Davis Hanson gave a list of ways in which the behavior of this Iraqi regime is similar to that of al-Qaeda. They both dabbled in terror. They both committed terror, more than dabbled. Both used nasty means and so on. But ties between these two are very hard to find, and I'm very doubtful the administration can make much of a case there are ties. And the reason is Saddam's government is exactly the kind of regime that al-Qaeda is dedicated to destroying. Al-Qaeda's whole
secular
essence, yes, their whole purpose in being is to bring the Arab and Muslim worlds back to purity, back to Islamic government, not secular government. They want to destroy these corrupt secular regimes. And Saddam is, he's the classic secularist they hate.
So if Al-Qaeda is not taking sanctuary in Iraq, and it's not quite as on the run as the Bush administration might suggest, how do you picture this organization right now? Cast your mind out there. What's going on with Al-Qaeda?
I think it's become a lot more protean and decentralized than it used to be. I think authority to launch operations has now been somewhat dispersed. I think they have relocated to two different havens.
Those being?
Northwest Pakistan, mm-hmm. where there's a region, the northwest frontier
wild
provinces.
Zone.
Yeah, wild zone. Pakistani government has no control there, and I think they're just running around, you know, having a great time in this very large area. And Yemen, where the whole outside the capital city, you know, not under government control.
And capacity as great as ever? Do they really have the freedom of movement, of interaction that would allow them to plan and pull off another major attack?
No, they don't. Whether they can operate globally is a question. Whether they can coordinate things globally now is a question. They're certainly being watched a lot more than they used to be.
That sounds like a victory of sorts. If they don't have that capacity, then aren't we winning?
Conversely, they've made headway in other areas, though. In particular, I think, learned a lot about our vulnerability. There's some scraps of paper we found in Afghanistan where they were chewing each other out for not thinking harder about the availability and utility of weapons of mass destruction. So my fear is that they're going to go to the next level in the next attack.
The candy shop is more crowded than they thought, and now they know it. Courtney's calling. Hi, Courtney. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I think if we look at Israel and their current strategy of using their current war on terrorism, they're having a little one over there. I don't think it's working too well, and it may give us a little bit of a lesson as to what might happen to us if we take the attitude that more and more weapons, more and more of this sort of tactical military solution is going to put us out ahead.
Do you have the sense that that's the road we're going down, Courtney, a road like Israel's?
Drain the swamp. You know, there's a bunch of evildoers out there, that these creatures that come out of nowhere to fight us. I appreciate that you guys have been grappling with the causes. And I think that, you know, Britain had to deal with it. Israel's going to have to deal with it. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is center stage. And this, you know, we're falling into bin Laden's plan, it seems to me. That bin Laden would love to see us go into Iraq to make more of justification to the fundamentalists that we are the sort of a Satan that needs to be fought more.
Courtney, we've got it. Thanks very much for your call, Stephen Evra. A couple of lines of thought here. One, that guns may not do it, that Israel has not, well, they fought and they fought and they have tamped down some of the attacks, and still it could hardly be considered solved. And secondly, this huge issue of motivation and how we address it.
Well, Courtney makes an excellent point about the Israelis not succeeding, but they're trying to do something much harder than what we're trying to do. They're trying to occupy, suppress, and rule a whole people who don't want to be suppressed and ruled, whereas presumably our war on terror, we're not about ruling and occupying anybody. But that's exactly where the two questions of war on terror and war in Iraq coincide.
How?
We're getting into the business of occupying and ruling folk here. If we occupy and rule Iraq, and unless, as I said, the whole war comes up like roses, we manage to hand things off quickly to other people, we're going to be in the role of occupier, which is the same one the Israelis are in. It's a very tough, very nasty position. And even if you've got a heart of gold and the best of intentions, in the end, rulers and occupiers wind up making people mad and taking a lot of blows to the head.
Steve Van Evra, you've got 20 seconds to whisper in the president's ear. What would you tell him on the war on terror front?
I'd say wage the war on all the fronts. Deal with the issues Jack Beatty was talking about. We have to change the terms of debate in the Islamic world. I don't think we should appease the worst complaints of the Islamists, but we have to argue with them where they've lied about us, which is often and on many dimensions. And in the areas where they have just complaints, we should listen to them, as in our trade policy and as in bringing about a just peace in Palestine.
Mm. There's the advice for President Bush. We'll see what advice he takes. Stephen Evra, it's always great to have you. Thanks so much for coming in tonight.
You're welcome.
Stephen Van Evra is professor of political science at MIT and a member of MIT's Security Studies Program. He's author of the book Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Jack Beatty, what a great large theater of war, and maybe more than one war here.
Yes, the two circles touching and then moving apart. You know, the claim about Iraq and democracy and that as the way to deal with our long-term troubles there. Today, a Times quoted a Saudi Arabian journalist saying, "I doubt you could find one person who'd agree that the Americans are coming just for the sake of democracy. We think it's oil. We think it's Israel. We think it's control. They want a police station in Baghdad like they have in Kabul." That's the mindset we're dealing with.
Do you sense that the Bush administration is still trying to put out a message that counters that?
I don't at all. I just think that they are not seeing this, and that they are dealing with a kind of substitute war, the substitute war, the optional one against Saudi Arabia, as opposed to the war that necessity has thrust upon us with Al-Qaeda.
Well, the clock ticks. We're in the game. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, On Point audio archaeologist Ned Connors chronicles the story of Henry Ford's anti-Semitism. This is On Point. In its most recent study, the Anti-Defamation League concluded that anti-Semitism in America is on the rise, reversing a decade-old decline. Anti-Semitism rose during another tumultuous period in U.S. history. In the years after World War I, Americans struggled in the so-called culture wars. The rise of industrialization, modernization, and immigration brought on a new brand of anti-Semitism spearheaded by automotive pioneer Henry Ford. Audio archaeologist Ned Connors digs up recorded sounds and voices from the past for On Point. Here, he tells the story behind the anti-Semitism of Henry Ford.
Like a fool, he brayed and he balked and he kicked the wheel, but he had to quit kicking to save his heels. When she blows out a tire, just wrap it up with wire and the little Ford will ramble right along.
When we think of Henry Ford, we think of mass production of Model Ts, the first affordable cars, massive industrial organization. But he was more than that. Ford was a combatant in the culture wars of the 1920s, an uneasy time when the rural certitudes of his youth were giving way to things modern. Ford, who did more to transform the way Americans lived and moved in the 20th century, jumped into the conflict with both feet. His role in the culture wars that accompanied our drive to modernity is worth a second look. Henry Ford once remarked famously in 1916 that history is more or less bunk. 3 years later, after more than 10 million Model Ts had rolled off the assembly line, he purchased a small local newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. With the help of a hired staff, Ford set about to write his own version of history. In the early 20s, his newspaper, sent to every Ford dealership in the country, revealed a dark, conspiratorial view of human history, that all the ills of modernity could be traced to a Jewish plot. The money changers of Europe and the East Coast commercial centers were causing wars and manipulating markets for their own profit, and for darker ends as well. World domination, an evil subterranean assault on what Ford saw as the Christian Anglo-Saxon foundation of everything temperate, thrifty, and wholesome. The Independent's anti-Semitic articles were compiled into four volumes called The International Jew. The book was distributed widely and translated into 16 different languages, including German. It found great favor with Adolf Hitler, a rising star of the German Nazi Party. One of the targets of the Dearborn Independent's attacks was the Tin Pan Alley songsmith. A 1921 article, "Jewish Jazz Becomes Our National Music," described jazz as Yiddish moron music. Syncopation was part of a grand plot to weaken American youth. One of the songs singled out in the article was "I'll Say She Does," sung here and co-written by Al Jolson in 1919.
I don't know much about her, and yet I know her love, and what it takes that makes me love her. I want to tell you she's got dirty.
With the approach of the 1924 election, Ford was emboldened to consider a run for the presidency. Will Rogers, the vaudeville storyteller and culture critic, had a few thoughts on his candidacy. Here he is recording for Victor in 1923.
There's no reason why there shouldn't be a Ford in the White House or everywhere else. He's the only man that could make Congress earn their salary. He would start a bill through and give each one something to tack on to it. When it come out, it would be ready to use. He is the only man that when Congress started stalling could lift up the hood and see what was the matter with it. Some are against him because he don't know history. What we need in there is a man that can make history, not recite it.
Ford soon gave up on his presidential ambitions, transferring those energies to an obsession with the preservation and recreation of the very world his mass-produced autos had done so much to change. He spent millions on the Henry Ford Museum in Greenfield Village and fought what the Independent had called the barbaric Orientalism in American music by bringing together an orchestra, Ford's old-time dance orchestra, to reintroduce the old quadrilles and country dances of his youth to a nation led astray by syncopated jazz. In 1925, Ford set up his own record label and dispatched songs like this standard club quadrille into the musical fray.
Grand right and left.
Ford did manage to generate a minor square dancing revival, but there was little he could do to alter the course of a popular culture giddy with jazz. In 1926, the Charleston was introduced as the latest in a series of dance crazes of the teens and 20s. In a great moment of cultural collision, Eddie Miller and his orchestra integrated the yelping klezmer clarinet into the Yiddish Charleston. So popular, they said, that even Henry Ford was doing it.
Millionaires with big personalities doing it every night. Millionaires of all nationalities need the Israelite. Oy, that Yiddish Charleston. Oy, that Yiddish Charleston. Henry Ford is learning how to Yiddish Charleston now.
In 1927, when Chevrolet was making serious inroads into his market share, Ford found himself in the middle of a libel suit brought by Jewish lawyer Aaron Shapiro. Concerned that a lawsuit would shine a harsh light on his cultural crusade, Ford decided to issue an apology to American Jews. He said he'd been so busy manufacturing cars that he hadn't realized what the Independent had been publishing in his name. It was too little too late. But many Jews were relieved that America's second largest weekly had given up on its delusional conspiracy. That moment of relief found its way into a 1927 popular tune sung in Yiddish-inflected English by Billy Jones and Ernest Hare, Since Henry Ford Apologized to Me.
Oi, oi, gewalt, gewalt!
What's the matter, Abram?
Did you see the Yiddish Journal this morning, Dovid?
No, what did it say?
Well, I don't mind telling you that I'm so happy I could cry.
You're looking simply great. Why don't you celebrate?
I bought myself a quarter hooch, a color, mid a tie.
Well, if I see you making whoopee, what's your alibi?
I was sad and I was blue, but now I'm just as good as you since Henry Ford apologized to me.
That's why you threw away your little Chevrolet, uh-huh, and bought yourself a Ford coupe.
There have been conspiracies throughout history, but what set Ford and his successors apart was the idea that there has been one big conspiracy, that human history is only a reflection of a cosmic battle between good and evil, and that evil is mopping up and preparing for the final assault. The fact that many Islamists and Nazi websites continue to disseminate the international Jew gives us some idea of the power and persistence of a piece of pseudo-history that really was, as Henry Ford might say, bunk.
All joined hands, forward and back.
Ned Connors is On Point's audio archaeologist. He lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.